Welcome to episode 4 of the In Our House Now podcast. This is season 2, and I'm joined by my co-host, John Thorne. I'm Josh Minton. So our green onions this week is something really simple. It's a video game. So the PS5 has one of their first exclusives out right now. It just came out this week that we're recording this, and it's called Returnal. And it's very much like, imagine you could play Ripley in the film Prometheus, and you're kind of walking around that type of environment, and you're shooting aliens, of course. But there are all these mysteries and a foreign language of the aliens. And every time you die, you come back with nothing but a little bit of your experience. And so it's this constant returning back to the beginning. Sounds familiar. That it's totally a Twin Peaks vibe with this coming back to basis, and then you have to run through it all again. So ultimately you have to keep going back through it until you get it right. And there's an element of chance and variability that switches around every time you come back. So it certainly has put me in the mind of Twin Peaks. And I think any Twin Peaks fan that's also a gamer out there with a PS5 should definitely consider it.
Very good. Time and time again, right? That's what it is.
Time and time again. Time and time again. So, John, our theme this week is on doors, thresholds, and border crossings. Talk to us about why this popped up in your brain, and we had such a great conversation a couple weeks ago about it. So I'd love to hear you kind of introduce it.
Yeah, I think it's a great topic. It's a really interesting thing to talk about. I've been writing in the last few months about part 17, and as I've been writing about 17, I've been thinking ahead to part 18, and you know, you tend to, as you look at it closely, these two parts of the return, you start to encounter a lot of door imagery and threshold imagery and border crossing imagery, and what, you know, how that all fits in with the overall story of Twin Peaks. And it occurred to me, this is actually something I wrote about many, many, many years ago in Wrapped in Plastic, and others have certainly written about it, was that the whole story of Twin Peaks essentially gets kickstarted by a border crossing. It's the fact that Ronette Pulaski crossed over state lines when she walked across that bridge early in the Twin Peaks pilot. And that is what brings the FBI into the town to investigate this crime, because it crossed state lines. And so it's a border crossing that brings Cooper to Twin Peaks. And from that point on, you see that there are these thresholds and these various border crossings that occur in the story. And it just seemed to me that as we get closer and closer to the end, season 3, The Return, those seem to condense. We get border crossing after border crossing after border crossing, and so I think it's meaningful. I think it has something to do with states of mind, locations, obviously, transformation of your psyche or your soul, and so all of that is symbolized by doors and thresholds.
100% agree. Like it's weird because in Twin Peaks, it feels like every mirror is a door. You know, I think it's just an interesting way to think about the show. And obviously there's the scenes in the mirror with Cooper staring at himself in both the finale of season 2, as well as the episode in the prison with Mr. C and looking at Bob's reflection as well. But I mean that in the sense of the reflections of other characters are indeed doors and mirrors inside of Twin Peaks, The Return. I wonder, John, if it wouldn't be helpful if perhaps we could start at the end and talk about kind of the final doors and then work our way back through. I think it's going to be a fascinating conversation if we could start at the last portal, which to me is the fade to black at the very end. I think if we could start there and then move our way backwards, we may get somewhere interesting.
Well, that's certainly a metaphorical border. There's a number of fades to black that happen in 17 and 18. And so there's this idea that there's a movement from one space or realm or zone to another, and there's a crossing that takes place. I mean, the word crossing pops up in part 18. I think it's Diane who says, once we cross over, it could all be different. I mean, right there, it's obviously talking about the idea of making this crossing. I guess at the very end, arguably, I'm not quite sure where I fall on this right now, but there's some sort of transformation that happens at the end, I would argue. I don't know if, well, I mean, boy, if you really want to start at the end, that's kind of tricky, but, you know, there is a literal door at the end of Twin Peaks that Cooper can't cross, and that is the door to the Palmer house. He gets to this door, and they are essentially blocked. It's interesting the way Lynch frames that, it stages that whole scene. He has Alice Tremond standing, you know, in the doorway. She opens the door, but she doesn't open it all the way. She opens it enough so that she can occupy the space between the door frame and the door, and she's sort of guarding, arguably she's guarding that threshold, and you can tell that Cooper wants to come in. he's probing gently, you know, who are you, you know, who owned this house before you. He wants to get in there, but he can't. And you know, he has up until that point been able to cross over and over and over again different borders and doors, but then that one at the end, he can't. So I think it's meaningful that Cooper takes this long journey, and potentially he reaches one last barrier. Maybe it's not the last, but it is for him, it's the last that he can't cross over. And so the story essentially ends there in a dead end for Cooper. Laura's a different matter. I don't know if I want to get into that right now, but for Cooper, you know, he's left sort of, he's sort of successfully, you know, been able to just jump over these hurdles and these thresholds. And then he gets to this last one, and that's the one that stymies him. And then he walks down into the dark, and he slumps over in confusion.
Yeah. I think, you know, I like to think of it as our journey with Cooper is over at that point. Our journey with Twin Peaks is over at that fade to black. Like, it's an ending of our point of view and our ability to kind of piggyback, you know, on whatever consciousness it is that's putting these images together in front of us on the screen. It's a dream or whatever, pick your character. But our ability to see and to put focus around the images and sounds that we're seeing and listening to is gone at the end of that. And so that's the final, you know, barrier, which is the removal of the viewer.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to look at it. I do think that the way the whole thing ends is that, whether it's deliberate on Lynch's part or just intuitive, there is a transformation or a threshold that is there, but we just will never see. We are incapable of making that crossing. Cooper is too. It could be that no one can make that crossing. My argument in other different kinds of essays is that everything essentially ends at that point. It all goes dark, but it restarts. And when it restarts, it's all brand new, whatever it is, the world, the universe, reality. And so we are of this universe, and so we can't see that one. So anyway.
Very similar to Hinduism, right?
Oh, yes.
So moving backwards, you know, we had that dweller at the threshold concept, but a great Van Morrison song, by the way. I love that song so much. This idea of Alice Tremond being at the final guardian, like there's no getting into that house for Cooper. He's just blocked, as you say. So, you know, moving backwards to the sign when they cross over into Twin Peaks, I believe there's a road sign that announces it. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, when they cross over a bridge, and the bridge is really interesting because Lynch takes a moment there to show the point of view of the car. You know, we're looking out the windshield, and it comes to this bridge and crosses over the bridge, and it's only there that we get this sort of ominous music cue. There hasn't been any music in the episode, or if there has, it's been, well, there was some music early on with Diane. There was a song playing, but the story does not have a soundtrack, you know, playing. There's sound effects and various things, but, you know, it's much more subdued. But when they get to that bridge and they cross that bridge, there is a music cue that's part music, part sound effect, and it's ominous sounding, and it signals. I mean, Lynch deliberately places that sound effect there as they cross the bridge, and so to me, it's a signal that something significant is happening. They're entering, maybe not a place. Actually, I don't think they're entering Twin Peaks, quote unquote, but they're entering a different time. I think a different time. You know, reality. I'm not quite. Arguably, they're entering the end of time. That they've gone as far into time as they can. But whatever you want to call it, that's my interpretation. But you could give it all kinds of different terminology. That border of that bridge is signaled to us by Lynch that it is now into this realm that's really important at the end.
I'm remembering our conversation about the emotional attachment to zones. I think it was in our zones. So this kind of bleeds back into that as a concept. You know, you say they're entering a timeless space that I would argue is mostly an emotional zone where we're now, if you could drive through an emotion, I feel like at the end, it's very bleak and still and silent, very quiet, you know, very morose in many ways, but also very simple in a way that Twin Peaks is not often accused of being.
Well, it's interesting, the whole thing there at the end. Cooper and Laura, other than Alice Tremond, whom we see only at the end, you know, they're the only two people in the whole universe essentially at that point. And when they do cross over the bridge and they come into Twin Peaks, they're driving through the town. But there's no one around. There's no one on the sidewalks. There's no one, you know, in the windows of the double R. I'm not sure the double R is even lit up. I can't remember. I should have checked out. I haven't written about part 18 yet. but you know, it's desolate. There, it's as if they've come to the end point of space and time here, and I think that bridge crossing signals that. And I should say, just as a quick, you know, note that it's curious to me, interesting to me, Lynch has done this before, and he did it in, of all movies, The Straight Story. You know, watching The Straight Story, I think one of the third or fourth time I was watching it, something stood out to me. You know, Alvin Straight is riding his tractor to reunite with his brother Lyle, and he's been going all this way, this long journey, and he wants to do it his own way, and he's taking this lawnmower to do it. And finally, he gets to the Mississippi River, and he crosses the bridge, and the camera stays with him down at his level as he's crossing the bridge, and you know, the trucks are going by, and so we are with Alvin as he makes the trip across the bridge. But at a certain point, maybe the halfway point on the bridge, I'm not sure where it is, Lynch does this unusual edit. He cuts to this bird's eye view or angel's eye view, I mean, way up in the sky looking down at the bridge. And I believe there's a music cue at that point, and not the happiest of music cues, like not a triumphant, he did it, he got, you know, to the river and he's crossing. It's somewhat, you know, I hope I'm remembering it correctly, and forgive me if I'm forgetting it, but I know that it is noticeable that there's this music cue, and it seems out of place. It doesn't seem like it should fit to the action that's taking place. So there's this disconnect there. And then the very next scene that occurs after that bridge, that shot from above, is at night in a cemetery. And Alvin is in a cemetery, and I believe he talks to the minister who comes out and speaks with him. And so, you know, you can read as much into that as you want or as little into that as you want, but it's interesting the way the point of view shifts to the sky, and then the next thing you know, Alvin is in a cemetery. And, you know, you could symbolically say, well, he died. He died. He got to the border crossing between life and death, and he died. And it's only after death he's going to reunite with his brother, who was deathly ill. Lots of different ways to look at that. And I'm getting way off on a Straight Story tangent, which is in its own way kind of contradiction.
Well, let's stop right there. And I just want to say, I love that reading of it. I think that makes the end of that movie all the much more meaningful to me. Just as a meditation on death, and giving someone that little bit of after story you know, after they sacrificed something like he's done, which was his time, it was his effort, you know, he really got out to meet the world again in a way that he probably hadn't for 50 years in his own life. And that was alone a liberation. I mean, I love that movie so much. So I'm sorry, you got me hung up on it. I want to watch it right now, now that you're talking about it.
No, it is a great movie. And for anyone who thinks it's not really Lynchian, it is very much Lynchian. Although he follows the script that Mary Sweeney wrote, and although it is a G-rated movie with essentially a straight story in it, he manages to, you know, insert some of these abstract components into it, and that bridge crossing is one. And then, not to get too far off on straight story, I don't want to do that, but there, after he crosses that bridge, some odd things happen that don't quite make sense to the rest of the story. One is that Alvin drinks a beer, and he said that he had given up alcohol, and another is he encounters this mysterious stranger on a tractor who just sort of magically restarts Alvin's stalled tractor. And these curious supernatural, or you know, elements take place after the border crossing, and they all add to the idea that whatever world he's in now, it's not quite the world he was in before the bridge. So I think, you know, I don't want to extrapolate too much from that to Twin Peaks, but it struck me that when Cooper and Carrie Page cross that bridge in Twin Peaks, that there's a music cue, and that's deliberate. And so it's meaningful. It means that that border, that world that they've gone into, is different than where they were before, and is obviously a significant place, probably the end of time and space.
Gorgeous. And you know, this idea of shedding people, you know, there was the driver behind them, which I remember the first time I watched that being very nervous about. It's like the members mm-hmm. only jacket guy in the final Sopranos. Like, he gets up and he goes into the bathroom, like, okay, what's going to happen here? And I remember being very, very paranoid, which I'm sure was intended. But we do essentially shed people. And the last person we see different than Cooper and Carrie Page is the dead guy in the chair, which is, by the way, another threshold. So that's our next threshold, was the door that Carrie Page answers and Cooper's on the other side.
I think the last living person that Cooper encounters is at Judy's Diner, which is the waitress who gives him the address to find Carrie. But there's a door there. Obviously, there's a door there. That door that Cooper knocks on and Carrie opens, I don't read as much into that one. There are other doors, which we should get to pretty soon, that seem more meaningful to me than that one. The way she opens the door and the first thing she says is, "Did you find him?" implies this long or somewhat detailed backstory, which we are never going to learn. That there is a story that led up to the opening of that door. That story's behind that door. Carrie has been through her own 18-part storyline, or her own movie, or whatever you want to, you know, her own narrative leads up to the moment she opens that door, and we join it at that point. But we are never going to know. We can never go back into it and find out what happened. All we can see are the after effects. What's left over, and what's left over is her question: "Did you find him?" We'll never know who him was, and obviously there's this dead body sitting in the chair, and we won't know what all of that is. I find that whole thing very interesting because, again, it implies this. Perhaps, you know, she had a story as long as Cooper's was, and here's where they intersect, and they intersect when she opens that door.
You know, that's, it just hit me that Cooper actually interviews at the door twice in this episode, or, you know, so the final one where he doesn't get through and this one where he does. So if I'm a lazier writer than Lynch and Frost, I might make this the end of the season. Why not Cooper being interviewed by Laura Palmer at the door and she slams the door in his face, as opposed to He convinces her to open up, let him inside. There is a situation from which there is no solution or return inside. There's no salvaging that situation uh-huh. that he walks into. Uh-huh. And then, you know, the next step obviously is to take her home to her mother's house, which obviously has its own implications. But why not end the show there if you're writing it?
You know, that's a really interesting way of thinking about it, because by walking into Carrie Page's apartment, he's exposed to, again, this entire universe of storyline that came to that moment. He can't make sense of it. Cooper's not interested really in making sense of it. He's got a mission he wants to accomplish. But it does imply the idea that if he had walked into the Palmer house, or the Tremond house, I guess we can call it, that he would have encountered the same kind of things. Maybe not a dead guy, you know, in a chair, but something else.
Well, what if she's talking to a dead guy in a chair, Psycho style, you know? You don't know.
Yeah, I mean, he might very well have opened up into some story that, again, it's impossible to resolve all the components of it. It's just, you know, this has happened to him once, and it could have happened to him again. Although, that's an interesting way of looking at it. I'm sure what was ever behind that door would have been mystifying. But the important thing psychologically, I think, is that Cooper is unable to make that final crossing to the Palmer door. And I think that symbolizes the fact that none of us are able to make that final crossing into whatever Laura screams into existence after the very end of the story.
So the one before that, the crossing, I'm gonna call it the sex ritual between Cooper and Diane, which we've talked about, you know, in our Diane episode. But I do feel like there is a cleansing moment there, a moment of transformation, certainly of perspective there, that happens that night.
Oh, there's no doubt that that's a crossing over that takes place in that motel room. Because when Cooper wakes up the next morning, when he walks out of the motel, he's in a different hotel. You know, the first one's a motel for sure. The second one might be there's a different car, you know, and he might even, he refers to himself as Cooper, but Diane has left him and moved on, or stayed in a different world. And Cooper has crossed over into a new world. And so that there's no doubt that that was a crossing over that happened. And it reminds me, and we may have talked about this in the Diane episode, so forgive me if I'm repeating myself, but that scene between Cooper and Diane in the bed, you know, that potentially opens up a movement to another world is something that we see in another Lynch film. And that's at the very beginning of Inland Empire. There are these two characters who go into a motel room. You can't see their faces. They're blurred. It's the very beginning of the story. And you have sex, and it is, it's afterwards that potentially that has led to a crossing over into a different world. And so there's a parallel between Cooper and Diane in that motel and that opening early scene, which interestingly enough has a spinning record in it at the beginning of Inland Empire. And so it struck me when I watched Inland Empire again that the scenes are very, very similar, that there is whatever happens between these two characters, it creates a portal or it opens a door. And at least one of, I think in Inland Empire, it's only the girl, the woman who ends up awake and alone, the man is gone. And so it's different in part 18, where it's just Cooper, but it's the same thing. It's the same thing. And I think Lynch was, I don't think he was trying to recreate that, but that idea, he's explored it once and he was exploring it again.
Well, I love the idea of, you know, the moment Cooper wakes up and like reads the note and he's like, Richard, Linda, you know, there's an element of risk, I feel like, between that through the diner scene and the moment that he gets up to Carrie Page's door and calls himself Dale Cooper, Agent Dale Cooper, I think he even says, there's a risk, I feel like, of losing his identity and possibly becoming someone different. You know, we I feel like there was a time in the first time I watched it where I'm like, is he even know he's Cooper still? Like, I really felt, you know, I was questioning myself.
Well, you know, it's funny you bring that up. I'm just thinking about this the last few days. The more I think about Part 18, the more I, you know, Part 18 is strikingly different than the 17 parts that come before it. And it's different in the way it's edited. It's different, you know, whether we talk about the music, it's different in the way, in some ways, you know, the camera, the way the camera stays with Cooper the whole time. It's a very grounded, it seems like it's been drained of all the supernatural, for lack of a better word, the abstractions. Although that is not true once he gets with Carrie and drives into the dark, then it becomes again, you know, infused with curiosities. But just speaking specifically about Cooper, as you were saying, to me, what works for me is that through part one through 17, we were seeing Cooper as he sees himself. He sees himself as this heroic champion who can fix everything. And in part 18, we're seeing Cooper as he is. We are no longer seeing Cooper through his prism. We are seeing Dale Cooper as Dale Cooper is. And he reads that note and he's like, this doesn't matter to me. I've got something else to do. I've got a mission to do. And then he gets into the Judy's and he's no nonsense there. He seems to care little for the delights of life. Coffee means nothing to him. He's on automatic pilot. And maybe that's how Cooper always is. We just have never seen him as he is until that moment.
Yeah, the idea of this romanticism, the idea of this sentimentality almost, of his attachment to things and people, Diane being one of the final obstructions to him accomplishing his mission, right? So that idea of him shedding these attachments that he had, we've talked about this before, and I feel like now we're working backwards through it. Part 18 is odd. It's almost like if you could hold up a Rubik's Cube that was all mirrors and you could see from different angles and just tilt it around. There's so much to see and it's so simple that it's deceptive.
Yeah. And I think we need to be very careful when we think about part 18 as being almost as an epilogue to the 17 parts that came before it. That in a way, the story's had a couple of endings, and I don't want to get too off target. We're talking about thresholds, but the story's had a couple of endings. Arguably, part 15 is an ending, and it's a significant ending. And then part 17 part 17 ends the exact same way part 18 does. Laura screams, and Cooper's left alone in the dark. So in some ways, you know, it doesn't matter if you watch. Well, I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to let those words come out of my mouth. You could stop at the end of part 17. You're missing a crucially important chapter if you don't watch part 18. But you could also just watch part 18, you know, and not watch the 17 parts that came before it. It stands by itself in many respects. So much of what came before it has been shed. It's been lost. And anyway, that's how I think of part 8.
I feel like if I could have used that argument that you just said last week when we recorded our best Twin Peaks episode ever, I feel like I might have won that argument. Because that was one of my choices for the best show ever was part 18.
Yeah, part 18 is, I mean, part 18 is fascinating. And I think if you look at it as a standalone episode, a standalone story, it is, no one's going to like this out there who's listening. It's season 4. Season 3 ended in part 17 and season 4 was part 18. Sorry, everyone. We're not getting anything else. So they've already given us season 4. There it was. It was one episode.